And informative guests, and you get one of the most listened to Saturday morning streaming media political talk shows going today. And it's all right here on our flagship station, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. So join me, The Fetch, for Inside the Eye Live every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern. It is truly intelligent media for the politically aware.
Tell you a little bit about Revolution Radio. Revolution Radio brings you a platform unlike anything on the internet today. A place where voices are heard, ideas are shared, and friendships are formed. So why not join the information revolution at freedomslips.com, where information never sleeps.
It's great. In your mind, does the world seem inverted, backward, dissonant?
Dare to think out loud.
You see your rights, freedoms, your very way of life being attacked, systematically eroded.
Dare to think out loud.
You observe traitorous evil rewarded, stealing the future from your children and grandchildren.
Dare to think out loud.
You question all the jingoistic propaganda claimed to be history.
Dare to think out loud.
You have tuned in to the right show.
Dare to think out loud.
Here's an expert on original source true history, your host, the Rebel Madman, Michael Gaddy.
Welcome, everyone, to this glorious insane asylum known as the United States of America. And our program is titled Dare to Think Out Loud, which I think I'm going to remove a word. And to the people of this country, I'm going to ask you just dare to think. That seems to be a real problem for most people today. Everybody has their emotions running in high gear at full speed ahead, but their brain has shut off a long time ago. We're going to really delve into that to quite a bit of detail today. And I have along with me two very good friends, Cal Robbins from Lake Havasu, Arizona, and my trusty producer, Dave Scorpio from south of the equator. Dave, say hello to everyone and tell them how we can keep this bastion of free speech called Revolution Radio going. Would you please, sir?
Oh, absolutely. Mike, good to be with you and Cal. This is going to be a good show. Guys, as everyone already knows, free speech is under attack, unlike anything we've ever seen in our lives. So come aboard freedomslips.com. That's freedomslips.com or revolution.radio. Come on aboard and become a Patreon member. Do whatever you can to help us keep this platform of free speech alive. And you can also mail stuff in through snail mail. Just scroll down to the very bottom of the page, and there's a physical address where you can mail in donations as well. So step up and come aboard, guys. This is more important than ever.
Oh, thanks, Dave. Sure appreciate that. And yeah, folks, help out. Any way that you can help Freedom Slips Radio, please do so. Because, you know, I'm going to tell you something. There's a lot of voices on this network, and I promise you we do not agree on a lot of things. But everybody has a right to express their thoughts, just like I did, because I did just a minute ago, because I don't think anybody in this country actually thinks anymore. Everybody is swollen up with emotions. Oh, and they're scared to death of everything that moves. We are ruled by a government that is dominated by lies and fear. If you can lie to the people and keep them afraid all the time, ruling them into whatever mode you want is never going to be a problem. Well, let me call in my old buddy Cal Robbins here from way out there in sunny Arizona. Cal, how's things going, partner?
Well, good morning, Mike and Dave. Good morning from the sunny southwest portion of the country out here. It's supposed to rain, but I see nothing but blue sky and clouds way off in the distance. So maybe we can get some rain because this desert does need a drink.
Well, I was on a program last night with my good friend Terry Dodd out of Parker, Colorado, and he's telling me they are looking at feet of snow for the next couple of days, not inches, feet, forecast of between 1 and 3 feet. And I told him how heartbroken I was here in sunny central Georgia with the temperature that's supposed to hit the 80s today, low 80s. So, it looks like some people are going to be in for some really nasty weather. Even here, I understand that by the end of the weekend, it could possibly have some nasty weather, which may even lead to tornadoes. So anyway,
yeah, and Mike, I was just reading that they expect low temperature records to be shattered again this coming week all over the country. So much for the global warming narrative.
Yeah, well, global warming only is used when the government needs it to be used, and they use it for carbon tax and for other stuff. Another way of raping the people on a daily basis, why the people get all jolly and feel good about themselves and run out and, make yourself sure that you put on at least 3 masks and get at least 5 vaccines. If 1 or 2 is good, 5 should be perfect. So, just really knock yourself out and become a clay pigeon for the trap shooters of the U.S. government. I got up this morning and I read an article, and I read this article, and Cal and I had already had plans for where we were going to go with this program today. And what I saw this morning just kind of set it off. The state of Virginia is going to spend over $1 million in taxpayer money to send 38 lawyers to the Virginia Military Institute in Lexington, Virginia, to try to uncover and to expose the systemic racism of that fine, wonderful college that's been there since 1839. So, now we've got to run back to 1839 to understand why that racism is actually in the lifeblood of VMI. But yet, we totally ignore the fact that racism was factored into this country's government with the Constitution of 1787. Now, whether you want to agree with it or not, which most people don't, I've seen idiots like David Barton come out and say, oh, well, it was a compromise. We had to have racism so that we could have government. And he's supposed to be a Christian, and he agrees that we should have a compromise with the devil so we can have government. Well, that's what we got. A compromise with the devil. But slavery was not codified, was not a part of the law under the Articles of Confederation. It wasn't. There was no mention of slavery. Not only that, but prior to the Constitutional Convention, which began in May of 1787 in Philadelphia, the Quakers sent a proposal by Tench Cox and by Benjamin Franklin. They sent a proposal to beg, to plead with the people at the Constitutional Convention to please abolish slavery in the United States under the new Constitution. Abolish slavery. Don't just leave it neutral and not mention it like the Articles of Confederation, but please abolish slavery and get rid of it. Oh, okay. Well, guess what? Tench, Cox, and Benjamin Franklin didn't even read it. At least there's no record if it was ever read. There is no record it was ever discussed. But what did they do at the Constitutional Convention? They agreed to have slavery in the Constitution, to make slavery lawful, and make it a part of the system. So systemic racism began with the new Constitution. And now that government that said they had to have racism, had to have slavery, where one human being can own another, regardless of the race, was put into the Constitution. And then, like I said, these wonderful revisionist historians say, oh, no, that, you know, it was a compromise. They had to compromise. Yeah, well, you know, good luck with that. But I thought so many times about what was about the discussions at the Constitutional Convention. What were the discussions about slavery? Because it was discussed on several occasions. Those wonderful delegates to the Constitutional Convention had every opportunity available to get rid of the terrible institution of slavery in 1787. And they chose not to. They chose to embrace slavery, to make it a part of the law, to make slavery constitutional in 1787. But there were people there who opposed it. And now we call those people anti-federalist. There was not a federalist out there who really voted against slavery. Not one. And in the writings of the Federalists, they did not oppose slavery. Look at the writings of James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, John Jay, the Federalist. Show me where they opposed slavery in the Federalist Papers. But this guy, this anti-federalist from Maryland named Luther Martin, he said this about the proposal to adopt slavery and to put it into the Constitution. I quote, "The revolution was grounded in defense of the natural God-given rights possessed by all mankind. But this Constitution is an insult to that God, who views with equal eye the poor African slave and his American slave master." Wow. So Luther Martin, who has no Christian background whatsoever that I can find, he was known to drink to excess, but was probably one of the best lawyers in American history, was the attorney general for the state of Maryland for almost 30 years, was involved in over 5,000 cases, represented slaves pro bono. Here was the man who allegedly all of these wonderful Christians at the Constitution were okay with slavery, but here was this lawyer who drank a lot, who was opposed to it, and he said that it was an insult to God himself. Wow. That is just, and the thing about it is the Federalists who were in charge of this Constitutional Convention and who ended up writing the Constitution cared nothing of embracing physical slavery in pursuit of their goals. But with that Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, they sought to make economic slaves of all of the people who would be forced to support their agenda with unlimited taxation from unlimited sources. Again, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1. So, and would you also believe that Luther Martin, the same guy who said that slavery was an insult to God, is the same guy who pointed out what they were going to do with this power of unlimited taxation? He opposed unlimited taxation on the people. And he, you know, and I'll read you a little bit of what he had to say in the argument about that. He said, by the power to lay and collect imposts, they may impose duties on any or every article of commerce imported into these states to whatever amount they please. Is that not true? Do we not now have that? Do you have any control over how much the government taxes imports? Do you have any control whatsoever? If you're going to say you vote, you're an idiot. And then he says, by the power to lay excise taxes, a power very odious in its nature, since it authorized officers to go into your houses, your kitchens, your cellars, and to examine into your private concerns. Oh, think about that. They don't physically go into your houses, your kitchens, or your cellars, but they do in various ways. And then he said, the Congress may impose duties on every article of use or consumption. Do we have that now? He says, on the food that we eat, on the liquor we drink, on the clothes that we wear, the glass which enlightens our houses, or the hearths necessary for our warmth and comfort. Is there any of those you don't pay taxes on, people? By the power to lay and collect taxes, they may proceed to a direct taxation on every individual, either by a capitation tax on their heads or an assessment on their property. Anybody pay property taxes? Do you have a tax on your head called an income tax? By this part of the section, therefore, the government has a power to lay what duties they please on all goods imported, to lay what duties they please afterwards on whatever we use or consume. In other words, by the time you get some products, they're taxed 3 or 4 times. To impose stamp duties to what amount they please and in whatever case they please. Afterwards, to impose on the people direct taxes by capitation tax or by assessment, but to what amount they please. And thus, to sluice the people at every vein as long as they have a drop of blood without any control, limitation, or restraint. And then he goes on, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but he goes on to say that all of the officers who collect these taxes and all of the judges who sit in on any tax case are all federal, not state. You're no longer represented by your states. You are consigned to the federal government, and that the judges who sit on your cases can be thousands of miles away from where you are. Luther Martin said that slavery was an insult to God, and he nailed the tax situation, and he was not a Federalist. He was an anti-Federalist. Luther Martin left the Constitutional Convention in August, late August of 1787, along with John Mercer, in utter disgust about what was happening there. Yet in America today, we go to school, which are the Marxist-dominated, Marxist-controlled, Marxist-dictated, read platform, the 10th plank of the Communist Manifesto, which guarantees or mandates government-controlled education. So if you go to a government school, they're not going to teach you anti-government truth. Cal, help me out here, son, before I get totally upset with these people.
I have a question for you. You mentioned that Luther Martin and Rutledge left the convention in disgust. What state was Rutledge from?
Oh, that was Mercer.
Okay. Whoever left, Mercer, was he from Maryland as well?
John Francis Mercer was also from Maryland. Of course, now let's not forget the two others from New York who left.
Yes. Well, what I'm getting at is, once they left, did Maryland have a quorum?
Yes, Maryland had a quorum because they sent seven people to the
convention. Okay, that was what I was trying to get at. I was in a discussion a couple of weeks ago on who all was at the convention and did not sign the Constitution at the end. And we were trying to compile a list of all those who actually had attended and either refused to sign at the end or had left and weren't there to sign it.
Well, there was only three that refused to sign at the end. George Mason, who said he would rather chop off his right hand. Yeah. And then, of course, we
Edmund Randolph, right?
Elbridge Gerry and Edmund Randolph. But Edmund Randolph was eventually bought off after he had initially said he couldn't sign it because it didn't have a Bill of Rights. He then became a staunch Federalist because George Washington promised him that if he would support the Constitution, he would make Edmund Randolph the Attorney General when the government began, and yeah. Washington did that.
Yeah.
So we know that Edmund Randolph was a true politician because he sold his soul for a political position. So on the
20th, I didn't mean to sway off from the topic.
No, you're good. You're good. I was just, I get into this stuff.
Why should I have an earlier time?
I get into this stuff and people really abhor, and I've found quite a few of them in various locations, including, unfortunately, our position that absolutely abhor the truth. If it doesn't agree with their lie, they absolutely abhor the truth. So let's jump forward into August. Now, you made a valid point, Cal, because John Lansing Jr. and Robert Yates, both of whom were Supreme Court justices from the state of New York, and they left the Constitutional Convention in utter disgust and wrote a letter explaining why they left. And they both said the reason they left the Constitutional Convention because to have stayed would have been to have violated the trust placed in them by the people of New York, because the people of New York did not authorize them to do what was being done at the Constitutional Convention. So two men of unassailable character said, no, we can't do this. We're going home. And how many times were we taught about that in the public gulag called the public fool system?
No, we're not.
So by the 21st of August, and it was very, very hot, one of the hottest years at that time on record in Philadelphia. And of course, they had no air conditioning, and they had put up blankets over the windows so that people couldn't see in or hear what they were doing inside. And they had sworn themselves to secrecy for 50 years. Now, everybody who is going to do something really good for you is going to keep it a secret for 50 years, I promise. Especially a politician. When a politician doesn't want anybody to know what they've done for 50 years, they are putting the screws to you, baby. And they don't want you to find it out while they're still alive. And that's exactly what the Federalists were doing. My opinion, I sell it for what it's worth. On the 21st of August, during the oppressive heat of that summer, the issue of slavery burst into full bloom at the Constitutional Convention. Again, when the subject was brought up, Luther Martin, now people, that's not Martin Luther. Those are two separate, totally different people. Most people in America think Luther Martin was Martin Luther because they've never been taught about Luther Martin. And for obvious reasons, if you read what he had to say about taxes and slavery, nobody wants that brought up. But anyway, Martin led off with his opposition to the slave trade by stating he was as interested in individual liberty for everyone, both races or all races, as he was for states' rights. Martin proposed an economically prohibitive tax on the importation of slaves when he stated again his disdain for the three-fifths clause. And I actually had an anarcho-Christian 2 days ago tell me that the three-fifths clause was anti-slavery. Really? You're going to tell me you take a man, make him a slave, and tell him he's three-fifths of a man, and that's anti-slavery? Of course, this anarcho-Christian was repeating what he had learned from the wonderful David Barton. Like so many other Christians who play his DVD tapes, which are replete with inaccuracy after inaccuracy. But getting back to Luther Martin, here's what he said, and I think it's very, very important, and I quote, he said that the three-fifths clause was inconsistent with the principles of the revolution and was dishonorable to the American character. Really? Why don't we hear anyone quoting Luther Martin? Isn't that what people are saying today, that this whole slavery thing was dishonorable to our character? Well, they put it in the Constitution. Nobody seemed to care about that. And of course, they said, okay, we're going to authorize this from 1798 for 20 years. But they didn't put any provision to end it into the Constitution. That's why we still had it. Then in 1857, the wonderful U.S. Supreme Court in Dred Scott v. Sanford said that slavery was constitutional. Systemic racism is the hallmark of the federal government. It's not the people from the South. It's not VMI. It's not Stonewall Jackson. It's not Robert E. Lee. It's the federal government that is embedded with systemic racism. Now, John Rutledge of South Carolina, who would be named to the Supreme Court by George Washington, so obviously he was a Federalist, and he became the second Chief Justice after John Jay, this is how he responded to Luther Martin. Religion and humanity have nothing to do with this question. What? And he said, interest alone is the governing principle of nations. So the economic interest trumps religion and humanity. Pardon that pun, I didn't mean it that way. Religion and humanity have nothing to do with this question. What he was saying was religion and humanity have nothing to do with the Constitution. It's about economics, the governing principle of nations. Again, the Federalist indicated that it was all about commerce and money. Religion and humanity were irrelevant to their pursuits. Charles Pinckney, also from South Carolina, and he would be a U.S. Senator from South Carolina in the first Congress. He stated, if slavery is wrong, it is justified by the example of all of the world. In all ages, one half of mankind have been slaves. So what the logic Charles Pinckney was throwing at the people was this. If you commit a crime, or if you know someone else has committed a crime, you can commit a crime and say it's now legal because somebody else did it. Isn't that what both political parties do today? The Democrats say, oh man, look, the Republicans did that, so we can do it. And the Republicans say the same thing. Oh, the Democrat, oh, hey, look, it's okay if Trump does this. Obama did it. So we have that same principle. Any comments, Cal?
Well, Mike, I'll jump in since okay. Cal is muted. I have a question. Oh, go ahead, Cal. I'll go after you.
I was going to comment that Mr. Rutledge went on to say even more stuff about that. You don't mind.
Well, I'm going to get to that.
Oh, okay. I'll leave it to you then, Mike.
I'm going to get to what else Mr. Rutledge had to say. Dave, you had a comment?
Well, yeah, I have like basically just two brief questions. You know, you've brought up this thing that, you know, that they had swore secrecy for what happened during the Constitutional Convention for 50 years. Was this just a oral agreement that was made? Is there any other documentation you've read that goes into why they did this?
Well, I think they didn't say why they were doing it, but I think it was obvious why they were doing it. The records of the Constitutional Convention, when they left in September, the records of the convention were put in the hands of George Washington, because the Federalists knew no one was going to demand the transcripts of the convention from George Washington. George Washington did not surrender those documents for 9 years.
Oh, wow.
If you're, this is a well thought out conspiracy. They knew what they were going to do before they got there. They did it, and then they tried to cover it up as well as they could. But some people, called the Anti-Federalists, begin to figure it out. And so Pinckney, again, here is what just lays out the whole program for the Federalists. Pinckney said this, and I quote, "The more slaves, the more produce to employ the shipping trade," or the carrying trade as he referred to it. "So the more slaves we have, the more business we're going to have." And then he said, "and the more consumption also," which meant if we bring them in, somebody's going to buy them. "And the more of this we have, the more revenue for the treasury." Oh, so it's okay to enslave people if it creates economy. And it's okay, especially if it creates revenue for the government. Again, it was an overt willingness of the Federalists to sacrifice morality on the altar of economic gain. But let's look at a gentleman who said he would rather cut off his right hand than sign the Constitution, George Mason. George Mason had some very relevant things to say, and George Mason was an anti-Federalist. Imagine that. Here's what he said. "Slavery discourages arts and manufactures." They, talking about the institution of slavery, "produces the most pernicious effect on manners. Every master of slaves is born a petty tyrant. They bring the judgment of heaven on a country. Providence punishes national sins with national with national calamities." Let me say that again. "Providence punishes national sins by national calamities." Need I say more than the Civil War? So, and then here we get into this great argument, and I've had this with I don't know how many people, and good people, and I don't think they think about it. But I had one recently. I mentioned this last night on that program as well. But I've had people say, well, if George Mason was against slavery, but yet he owned slaves. Thomas Jefferson was against slavery, but yet he owned slaves. Patrick Henry was against slavery, but yet he owned slaves. So they were total hypocrites. Because they said they were against slavery, but they tolerated it. And the individual who asked me that is a professing Christian. And he says, well, they were just hypocrites. And I said, well, do you oppose abortion? And he said, naturally, I oppose abortion. I'm very much against it. I said, well, we've had abortion for 48 years. What the hell have you done about it? Do you still tolerate it? What's the difference between you and Mason and Patrick Henry and Thomas Jefferson? He didn't have an answer. But Mason previously said, talking about, he was consistent, because 20 years before the Constitutional Convention in the late 1750s, George Mason had said that slavery is a slow poison, is daily contaminating the minds and the morals of our people. Every gentleman here is born a petty tyrant. He was talking to fellow slave owners. Practiced in acts of despotism and cruelty, we become callous to the dictates of humanity and all the inner feelings of the soul, taught to regard a part of our own species in the most abject and contemptible degree below us, we lose that idea of dignity of man which the hand of nature has implanted in us for great and useful purposes. Unquote. Systemic racism. The first slaves were brought to the United States by King James, and then Henry VIII brought them, and then King George brought them. King James brought all of the, they brought them. The people in the states did not have an option on slavery, the people in the colonies. The king brought them, and by golly, you were going to use them. And the Constitution said the same thing as the King of England. We're going to keep doing it because it produces revenue. Regardless of the morality, regardless of the religion, they were going to keep doing it because of the economic gain. And of course, this anarcho-Christian told me, he said, well, he said, you know, the North was really against slavery. I said, is that correct? He said, yes, they were, because shortly after the Constitution, several states outlawed slavery. And I said, yes, they did. Because those states would have wanted slavery removed from the Constitution. But the federal government wouldn't do it. So the states did it on their own. But let's not forget that 70 to 90% of the slaves brought into this country were brought in from shipping interest in New England. So the people who brought them in may not have cared about slavery, but they cared about the money. Now, Oliver Ellsworth is a interesting character. He was a Federalist. And he said that the only reason that George Mason wanted to eliminate slavery was because that the slaves were reproducing so fast in Virginia. Virginia wanted the market on slaves, and they didn't want people to bring them in for competition. Well, could that be true? That wasn't what George Mason said. George Mason said it was a moral wrong. Luther Martin, who never owned a slave, said that it was a crime against God. Now, John Dickinson, who was the author of the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union, attacked the institution of slavery and the transportation of slaves, saying it was inadmissible on every principle of honor and safety. So, but let's think, let's go to another one of those wonderful Federalists named Nathaniel Gorham of Massachusetts, who was actually president before George Washington, but he was president of the Articles of Confederation, so we don't mention that. Nathaniel Gorham also at one time was thinking about bringing in a prince to be king of the U.S. in 1786, and that's documented. He was actually, the Congress was thinking about bringing in a king from a foreign country to rule our country. That's how these wonderful Federalists think. But Nathaniel Gorham said at the Constitutional Convention that he desired it to be remembered that the northern New England or eastern states had no motive for the Union except on a commercial basis. So again, the Federalists mention exactly it was about money. It wasn't about the liberty or freedoms of the people. You have a constitutional right to be a slave. You have a constitutional right to pay unlimited taxes from unlimited locations, unlimited areas. There is no limit to taxation that the federal government can do. As a matter of fact, now the federal government, during the COVID thing, was talking about a thing called wealth as wages to where anything you own that could be considered wealth, like your 401k or your IRA or your bank account or your property, you could be paying a federal property tax. These are in consideration. You think that this country that's giving away trillions of dollars right now is not going to come after your money with that in effect? So they came up with this idea of the 20-year extension of slavery. Now, I give James Madison credit because he objected to the provision of the 20 years of slavery being put into the Constitution. He didn't offer an alternative, but he objected as a person, not as a state. He only had a vote. And all of the votes were taken as states. Which Cal brought up a great point. When two of the three delegates from New York left, New York no longer had a voice in the Constitutional Convention. Alexander Hamilton was there and voted individually, but the state of New York no longer had a vote. So they had the vote as to whether they would put in the 20-year provision for taxation. And so the vote was 7-4 with New Jersey, Delaware, Virginia, and Pennsylvania voting against the extension of slavery. Noticeable in this vote was the fact that Maryland and all of the shipping-oriented states of New England voted for slavery. They voted to extend the slave trade. Also imposed with this same measure was a duty placing a $10 per each tax on each imported slave. This measure passed again with the identical 7-4 vote. Again, Nathaniel Gorham of Massachusetts spoke in plain terms the motive for the Federalist-dominated states of New England as referenced their profits to be obtained from the slave trade when he stated, if this government is to be so fettered as to be unable to relieve or enrich the eastern states, what motive can we have to join it? The New England states joined for money, for profit. So the newly minted Constitution, when ratified, would heavily benefit the shipbuilders and the owners who shipped slaves and the southern plantation owners who bought them at the expense of all of the consumers in every state, whether they owned slaves or profited from it in any way. The fact that delegates to the convention made such arrangements and accommodations for shipping and the slave trade, but refused unanimously a motion to add a Bill of Rights, should provide all evidence needed to determine the ulterior motives of those who conspired to propose this new form of government. If that is not sufficient for you, why did the authors of this Constitution, which embraced the immoral slave trade, work so diligently to keep from using the word slaves or slavery in their final document? Why did they insist on the use of other persons, such persons, or persons held to service, instead of saying slaves? Is that not deception? A government based on such deceptions would obviously later embrace the wonderful terms of Patriot Act, or Affordable Health Care Act, or Stimulus Package. Make any sense, Cal?
Yeah, it's you can definitely see the pattern going there. Morty, again, back to your point, Rutledge, he said this about the northern states. Now, he was from South Carolina, wasn't he?
Right, yes.
Okay, he said, there, let me pull it up. He said, the true question at present is whether the southern states shall or shall not be parties to the Union. If the northern states consult their interest, they will not oppose the increase of slaves which will increase the commodities of which they will become the carriers. So he was pointing out to the northern states that it was in your best interest to continue the slave trade, because you will make money off of it by being the shippers, by being the carriers of the slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And the northern states went along with it. So, yeah, just more evidence to your point.
Well, to me, it's just absolutely incredible, Cal, when we look at this. It's just so incredible that people just keep falling for this. And now, by the very term, systemic racism, by the very term, let's look at it. The systemic racism definition. Now, after what we've said about the Constitution embracing slavery, then the Constitution came up with, the government came up with the Dred Scott Act in 1857, stating slavery was constitutional. And 3 years later, when the Southern states put in their, when they said, okay, we're getting out of the Union, we're seceding, and they put in their secession documents, they mentioned slavery. They were standing on the Constitution. They were not unconstitutional. They were standing on the Constitution and the Supreme Court decision in 1857. But the South gets blamed for racism. How does that happen? But let's go back. Institutional racism, systemic racism. Here's the definition. Now tell me this isn't into the very government at its very core with the Constitution. It says racism resulting from the inherent biases and prejudices of the policies and practices of social and political organizations, groups, or institutions. So the U.S. government's an institution. Did they put in an inherent bias in the Constitution of 1787 with slavery? Yes. Did they put in a prejudice in the Constitution of 1787 with the adoption of slavery? Yes. So where is the systemic racism? Where does it originate from? Not with Virginia Military Institute. Not with Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, and others. Where does systemic racism begin? And who codified it over and over and over again? You know, the Supreme Court said not only Dred Scott, but the Supreme Court said it was a crime punishable by prison time in a case, in an Alabama case, for a black to marry a white. Both of them could go to prison. Is that racism? Is that systemic racism held by the Supreme Court? What about Plessy v. Ferguson? A Supreme Court decision which said separate but equal. Okay, yeah, you can be equal. You just can't go where we go. Is that equal? Systemic racism in the Supreme Court. Then what about the Civil Rights Act of the 1860s that were repealed by the Supreme Court in 1870s that brought on all of these Jim Crow laws? But yet, who's to blame for that? We don't blame the Constitution. We don't blame the Supreme Court. We blame the Southern people and Southern symbols. And we blame a Southern flag that flew over a government for 4 years, when the Stars and Stripes flew over a country of slavery for 81 years. Now, even you people with this new modern Common Core math have to be able to make the discernment that 81 is more than 4. Help me out here, Dave. I'm getting wound up.
Well, Mike, you said something very interesting. I've never heard that they were actually going to bring a prince to be king. Do you have any information about who this man was and what country he was from and that, et cetera?
I do. I don't have it in front of me. I'll try to have it when we come back in the second hour. I think I can find that.
That's astonishing. I've never heard that before.
Yeah. Gorham, as the president of the Congress, we had seven different, or eight. I'm trying to think exactly which one it was. But we had eight presidents before George Washington. Again, we're not taught that in school, because they were presidents of the Congress. So they weren't considered presidents over the states, but they were presidents over the Congress. And Gorham worked through, and of course, the U.S. government tried to deny that for years, that such a thing had happened. But then the evidence showed up in a foreign country of the actual letter to this prince offering him to be king of the U.S.
So, well, and it's amazing that things didn't descend into chaos before we had a federal government and a president of the states.
Yeah, that's kind of crazy that that never happened, huh? That is kind of crazy. Cal, jump in here, buddy.
Well, you started off with the systemic racism at VMI. What systemic racism at VMI? Well, where did this allegation even come from?
Well, Cal, I went into that, and I've got to admit a little bit of bias here, people. My son, Christopher, graduated from Virginia Military Institute in the year of 2001. I spent a lot of time at Virginia Military Institute, and during his tenure there, I talked to an awful lot of people. That was a choice he told us when he was a very young man. Mom, Dad, this is where I'm going to college. We had visited there in Washington and Lee University. We had visited them on vacation. We had gone, they're just right across the street from each other, Washington and Lee. Of course, they're going to do away with the Lee in that. It's just going to be Washington University. So we're going to have a man who supported slavery in the Constitution. We're going to keep his name, but the guy who fought against domination of a federal government over everything, we're going to get rid of his name. Now, doesn't that make a lot of sense? Yeah. Okay. Let's keep the name of the guy who actually promoted and owned slaves. Let's keep his name, but let's get rid of Robert E. Lee. Okay. That makes all the sense in the world. That is just back to the title of the show. Dare to think, damn it. It's not going to happen. I'm sorry. But anyway, here we are with this, again, Cal, I hope I answered your question.
Well, no, who made the allegation that VMI was racist? I mean, the student body doesn't reflect it. Their curriculum doesn't reflect it. I'm just wondering where they came up with this.
Well, my son and I did a show on that, and did an hour and a half show 2 weeks ago on Blog Talk Radio on Handling the Truth. And my son, I had my son come on because he's very much involved with the people still at VMI and very loyal to his alma mater. And I had him come on and explain it, exactly what was going on and what's going on at VMI. And that is something I saw way back when he first entered VMI, was that VMI is a very tough system. When you enter VMI as a first-year student, you are called a rat. And rats have a very tough, the first thing they have is called Hell Week. And then the rats, until what they call breakout, which usually happens in January or February of their first year, they are just subject to all kinds of practice and physical work and all of this other stuff, which they have to do. They go through this, and my son explained it in great detail and how much it meant to him to go through that, because he knew he had accomplished something. And so and they eliminate over half of their first year students with this rat line. It's either get tough or get gone. So they do this, they put that together. And ironically, when I found my son's cadre when he first entered back in 97. I found a member of his cadre, and I told him, I said, look, I'll give you $100 if you can run my son off. I want you to be tough on him. I want you to be as tough as you can be and see if you can run him off. And he agreed. His name is Joey Bates. Joey Bates is a great guy. And he couldn't run my son off, although he tried very hard. But I'm really proud of that because he endured a tough system. But see, here is what happened, and we're probably going to have to come back on the other side to complete this. But I do want to answer that question for you, Cal, because what happened is VMI decided they wanted to have really good athletic teams. And what they found out was they couldn't get top athletes from high schools to come to VMI and to go through the rat line. They were not going to come there and have, because if they were superstars in high school, they wanted people bowing down and praising them, especially the inner school, inner city athletes. They wanted special attention. They wanted, stuff that other schools were doing, how the alumni would buy them shoes and all this other stuff. All of that's not permitted at VMI. All right, guys, we'll come back on the other side, and I will finish telling you about the VMI situation.
Unto the daughters of men, indicating that there were giants before the Nephilim.
And sons of God, plural. They weren't talking about Jesus coming down.
No, that's right. Yeah.
I'm Steve Crawford, host of Factor Theory Live. Join me every Sunday night from 10 p.m. till midnight Eastern Standard Time on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Check it out.
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind. Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, and you will catch the Fenton Perspective with our great host, Lorian Fenton. Come listen in as she shares her amazing stories from the past to present, along with all of her guest secrets to the future. That's the Fenton Perspective every Monday evening right here from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, only on Revolution Radio. Oh, and you don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm, as expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
Treat us fairly, you are lying to yourselves, because we know who they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. The time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener supported radio station on the planet, not giving up. Revolution Radio. Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Welcome back, inmates, to Dare to Think Out Loud. Just Dare to Think. I think I'm preferring that more and more. Whether you think out loud or think to yourself, if you would just freaking think instead of feel your way through life. So anyway, today we're discussing, racism, systemic racism. And my friend Cal had asked the question about VMI. I guess a little background is necessary. Probably the most famous graduate of, the most famous person affiliated with the Virginia Military Institute was Stonewall Jackson. And Stonewall Jackson was a professor at VMI. And he is buried in Lexington, Virginia, and he was killed during the our Second War for Independence, as he called it. He did not call it a civil war, I promise you. So he was nationally associated with the Confederacy. Now, some ironic things here, Cal and Dave. Stonewall Jackson, never owned a slave. Never. And he was breaking the law at Virginia Military Institute. He was breaking Virginia law because in his church, he was teaching blacks to read, to give them an education, to help them further themselves in life. That was against the law in Virginia in 1860. But he was doing it anyway. So, but because he was a general in the Confederacy and arguably the greatest tactician in military in that era, because of that, he was viewed as a part of systemic racism. So this shows you the insanity. A man who never owned slaves, who actually was breaking the law to educate them, is treated as an issue of systemic racism. So the governor told the governor of Virginia to be politically correct and to advance his cultural Marxist background, decided that the statue at Virginia Military Institute of Stonewall Jackson should be removed as a symbol of racism. And so he pushed the commandant or the head guy at, it's not the commandant, there's another name for him, but the head guy at VMI, the general, he pushed him to remove, back in last fall, to remove the statue of Stonewall Jackson. The general refused, General Pease, he refused, And so he was asked to resign because Virginia is a state-controlled institution. So he was asked to resign, which he did. So then the governor proceeds with his investigative panel. You might as well call him the Stasi. So the state Stasi. So he continued. So what they did between November, they knew that many of the cadets would protest them trying to take out the statue of Jackson. There's Jackson Hall, there's Jackson Arch, there's so many things. Jackson's war horse, Little Sorrel, is actually stuffed in the museum. They actually have his horse in there and his uniform. They have so many things of Stonewall Jackson. They're probably gone now. But they had so many things of him, and they knew that the cadets would probably protest. So when the cadets went home for their Thanksgiving break, after they left, they were sent home a notice. All were contacted and told not to come back until after Christmas. So there was no return after Thanksgiving, and then go to class until the Christmas break. And then, so they extended it. And while the cadets were home, they removed the statue of Stonewall Jackson. So they didn't want, because they knew if the cadets protested, that would go against everything that they stood for. And it would expose their fraud. So they wanted the cadets gone. So the cadets, they told the new commandant, or whatever they call the guy, to tell them all to stay home. So they removed it while they were gone. And then to further justify this now, they have sent in, and they're operating on some complaints. Well, Cal and Dave, when you matriculate at VMI, you take a very solemn oath. I will not lie, cheat, steal, nor tolerate those who do. That's the cadet oath. Very simple. Well, and if you do, you are what is referred to, and my son gave a very graphic illustration of what happens if you are tried by a court of your own, not the administration, but the court that you're tried under for violating the honor code is held by the cadets themselves, not the administration. The school doesn't do it. The cadets police themselves at VMI. So if you are convicted, you are drummed out. And I mean, that is a literal, because you're brought in, the charges are read, you are expelled from school, and the whole time that you are, they beat the drums. And all cadets have to attend the proceedings, usually held about 1 o'clock in the morning. So you, once you're out, and then part of that is they say that cadet so-and-so has been convicted of this charge of violating the honor code, and therefore their name will never more be mentioned within these walls. So if you violate the honor code, they can't even mention your name anymore. That's how sacred this oath is to that institution. So what happened here is the school decided, even, you know, back in the 90s, that they wanted to be competitive in athletics. And so they found out that they couldn't get the athletes, a lot of athletes, prime athletes, to come to VMI because they had a rat line. They didn't want to go through all of the stuff that the other cadets did. So the institution relaxed their mandate. And so if you were an athlete, you didn't have to go through the rat line like everyone else did, which was a tragic mistake because you created two bodies of people within the same university. So what happened is there was a cadet who was caught cheating. The professor actually had an observer to observe this man And he was an athlete. He was a football player. And he was caught cheating. He was tried by his own cadet corps, not the administration. He was tried, and they drummed him out for a violation of the honor code. So he goes to the Washington Post and claims he was drummed out because he was black. So the point of it is when you're drummed out, the records are sealed. Only the person who was drummed out can have those records made public. The Washington Post, when they were notified, asked him to verify his case if he would agree to have his case have all the documentation of his trial, if he would have all of his documentation released, and he refused to do so. Well, if you're innocent and they only kicked you out because of your skin color, why would you not want to offer the proof? But anyway, then in line, you've got the people who like to jump on the bandwagon. So you had people coming back and saying, oh, yes, I remember I was at BMI and they were racist to me. And, you know, all of this stuff happened. Cal, do you know anyone whose son, not me, of course, but do you know who anyone important whose son graduated from VMI?
Not offhand, no.
Dave?
Well, I think you mentioned that the Chief Justice, forget his name, I'm sorry, his son went there, correct?
Not the Chief Justice.
No. No, not the Chief Justice, no.
Okay, yeah. So we have the justice. Oh, gosh. The name just escaped me right there in the middle of that thought.
Thomas.
Clarence Thomas. Clarence Thomas. Clarence Thomas's son graduated from VMI. And if you will notice in all of this, Clarence Thomas will not say a word. And all of these things that are going on, he keeps it totally quiet because he has, you know, an iron in the fire. His son graduated from VMI. And I will always remember my son's third class year when we were there for Parents Week, which is usually in October. And we were there and we're sitting in Lejeune Hall. And I turned around and I looked and I saw this gentleman sitting at a table a little bit away from our table. And I said, that guy looks exactly like Clarence Thomas. And my son looked at me and he said, well, Dad, that's probably because that's who that is. So being the shy, bashful person that I am, I went over and introduced myself. And for what it's worth, I was very much impressed with Justice Thomas as a person. We didn't talk about the Supreme Court or anything. Except we did talk a little bit about the Second Amendment. But that is a subject for another day. But anyway, we haven't seen Clarence Thomas's son come out and say that it was a racist institution. Who are the people who are claiming it's racist? But because it's a popular cultural Marxist viewpoint right now, everybody's jumping all over it. So the wonderful governor of Virginia, seeing blood in the water that he's already created, is going on the statement of this man who was drummed out for being dishonest. And the Washington Post has jumped all over it as well. Oh, well, the only reason he was kicked out because he was black. Folks, do you want to go to the U.S. Naval Academy and check into racist incidents that's happened there? You want to go to West Point and check in and see what racist activities have occurred there that people have been kicked out of school for? You want to do that? No, you don't, because they're not in the South and they had nothing to do with the Confederacy. So it doesn't matter. It was just like guys, I'm going to jump ship here and talk about something else, but you guys are both familiar with what happened on January 6th of this year, right?
The lamest insurrection ever?
Yes, the insurrection at the Capitol, where all of these people are now being charged for all of these trials.
Guys, the self-guided tour.
Are you familiar with January the 27th, year 2007? No comment, huh?
Not, doesn't ring a bell to me.
No, me either.
Okay, on January the 20th of 2007, I believe the President of the United States was Barack Obama. No, I'm sorry. It was George W. Bush. It was before Barack Obama. My bad. So George W. Bush is president. And what is going on at that time? There is a war going on, right? Which is still going on. But there was a war going on. And who was protesting against the war? Oh, the Democrats. The Democrats put a lot of people in Congress in 2008 and the president in Barack Obama into office on anti-war principles. Of course, as soon as they got their members of Congress in and they got their president in, all protest of the war evaporated. But on January the 27th, over 100,000 people gathered around the U.S. Capitol in an anti-war protest. And hundreds of those people stormed the Capitol. There were some arrests. None of them were shot. Another flash in history that doesn't make sense, does it? What was it? Those who failed to remember or to learn the lessons of history are destined to repeat its mistakes. Now, I wonder why rushing the Capitol in 2007, if you are a Democrat, is not near as serious a crime as if you rush the Capitol, invited in on a tour, in 2021. But everybody is bad. People, I'm not defending Donald Trump. No way. But Trump did give a speech there. Who gave a speech to the people who were protesting the war in 2007? A congressman from California. Democratic congressman. Anti-war, had been elected on an anti-war protest in 2006. Were they charged with creating this great, were they impeached for creating or making a speech which made hundreds of people rush the Capitol? No. Dare to think. Cal, help me out here, buddy. Got any more questions?
Yeah, you mentioned that they seem to want to remove all things Jackson, even though he never, ever owned a slave. What about the Union generals that did throughout the war or prior to the war own slaves? Because as far as I understand, there were four of them that did. One of them being Grant, another one being Sherman.
Wait a minute, Cal. Grant didn't own any slaves. Grant's wife owned those slaves.
Then how could he emancipate it if he didn't own it?
Well, that's the way it's listed. Alexander Hamilton didn't own any slaves, but he bought some for his brother. Isn't it wonderful the way that history is contorted? I didn't mean to run over you there, Cal. I did it for effect.
No, that was fine.
But
democracy just abounds, and it blows my mind, you know. And it's just, I guess it's just out of ignorance, and I guess ignorance comes from not thinking, not knowing.
You completely take all intellectual properties and throw them in the garbage can, and you do everything in your life based on emotions. And that is where this country is today, and you cannot rule your life with emotions. You can't do it. But that's exactly where we are. People put on a mask because they're scared. They shut down their businesses because they're scared. You know, and that's always troubled me about Christians, because I had the people who call themselves Christians tell me the Lord's will be done. You know, whatever's going to happen is going to happen. Really? Why'd you put on a mask? Why did you close your church? Why did you do all this stupid stuff? If you really believe the doctrine of Christianity that you preach, why do you do all this stuff? Dare to think out loud or to yourself. Just dare to think.
Because still trying to figure out how the Democrats and Biden are able to outsmart God and place him in charge, because God placed Trump in charge. I'm still trying to figure out how the Democrats outsmarted him.
Yeah, well, you know, that's, you know, we can go back to, you know, and as a matter of fact, I did on a previous program, you know, go back to that old racist, you know, George Wallace, go back to that racist, and then look at what he had to say, and then make the determination. Do people hate George Wallace because of what he said? Or, well, yeah, they're going to say, okay, we hate him because he said, you know, all of these racist things. He really did. He said these racist things. So, you know, what can we do? Well, you know, gosh, guys, let's look at something else, okay? Again, I've brought this up before. Let's look at these racist Supreme Court decisions. Now, somebody help me out here, but the Supreme Court is part of the federal government. Isn't that right? They have nothing to do with the state governments. That's all the federal government operating under the Constitution of 1787. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, you're correct.
So in 1857, the Supreme Court says slavery is constitutional. The court ruled against Dred Scott, even though the court of Missouri had set him free. The U.S. Supreme Court overruled a border state and said, no, we don't care what you said, Missouri. Slavery is constitutional. Dred Scott is a slave, and he will be a slave, and you can't set him free. Okay, so then let's jump to, you know, 1883. Let's look at, what is that? Pace v. Alabama, U.S. Supreme Court. In 1883, Alabama, interracial marriage was 2 to 7 years of hard labor in the state penitentiary. A black man named Tony Pace married a white woman named Mary Cox, and they challenged this law. Well, maybe they didn't get married. They challenged the law first. The Supreme Court upheld the law, which made it a crime for a black to marry a white. And they upheld it on the grounds that the law, inasmuch as it prevented a white from marrying a black and also permitted a black from marrying a white, was race neutral. So it was still constitutional for the people in Alabama to be put in prison. Okay, for marrying. All right, let's look. Also in 1883, let's look at the civil rights case of 1883. Now, this one is really good because the Civil Rights Act, which mandated an end to racial segregation in all public accommodations in 1875. Now, we don't hear about this 1875 version because it was struck down by the Supreme Court in 1883. So a Civil Rights Act was passed by Congress and signed by the president, which said we will put an end to racial segregation in all public accommodations, trains, restaurants, any place that one person can go that's public of one race, all people can go to. So that Civil Rights Act was passed in 1875. But guess what? It was overruled in 1883. And the Supreme Court said, yes, you cannot allow blacks and whites to drink out of the same fountain. Yes, you cannot allow blacks and whites to be on the same train or the bus or anything else. The Supreme Court struck down the law that said we could have equality. The Supreme Court struck it down in 1883. Now, y'all remember being taught that in school, right? Had the Supreme Court simply upheld the 1875 Civil Rights Bill instead of changing it in 1883, there would have been no Jim Crow laws. There would have been no separate but equal. There would have been none of that. Who brought racism back to this country in 1883 after a terrible war had been fought, although that war wasn't fought to free the blacks? That's a total misconception. But the Supreme Court brought back racism in 1883 and said, oh yeah, you passed a law that said blacks and whites could eat in a restaurant together, ride a bus together, ride a train together, they could go to church. Oh no, we can't do that. You got to separate them. In 1883. Then in 1896, the Supreme Court said that, and Plessy v. Ferguson, that yes, blacks and whites are separate but equal. Is that not segregation? Is that not the very definition of segregation, people? Was that not the Supreme Court who did that? Oh, let's also look at another wonderful case of the U.S. Supreme Court, the federal government, not a state, in Cumming v. Richmond in 1899. Now, this one is especially egregious. Think about this. Three black families in Richmond County, Virginia, faced the closing of the area's only public black high school. They're closing down the black high school in Richmond, Virginia, because, you know, there's just not enough people to go there. It didn't justify the expense. So we're closing down the school. And so the families of those three black families petitioned the court to allow their children to finish their high school education at the white high school in Richmond County. Guess what? The Supreme Court said if there was no suitable black school in a given district, black students would simply have to do without an education. Systemic racism. It's been in this government, the federal government, since 1787. So, Cal, Dave, any comments?
Well, Mike, I would just add about this whole conversation about, you know, systemic racism that we're always hearing, you know, go on and on about now. It's really, if you look at it, it's simply just a power grab by the federal government, because the solution to so-called systemic racism is more rules and regulations by the federal government. That's going to be how it plays out. And that's really all there is to it. Anything else is, like you said, emotion. This is another power grab.
Well, let me see if I got this right now, Dave. The Supreme Court is going to say, the federal government is going to say that the cure for all of this problem is to leave this up to the federal government that's been racist since its beginning. Is that what you're going to tell me? And I've just proved that beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, you're not supposed to think about that part, Mike. Come on.
Oh, I'm sorry. should I just go back to sleep and feel good about all of this stuff?
That's pretty much it. Just feel good that the federal government's going to fix everything for us. I think that's really, you know, all we're supposed to do, as they take more and more power away from people's individual choice and ability to interact with one another.
Oh, wow. Okay. So Okay, so the answer to the problem of racism is more of what brought us racism. Does that make sense?
Well, we need the strong hand of the federal government to regulate every aspect of our lives because we're incapable of doing it on our own. Otherwise, we're just going to be racist and treat each other badly. I think that's really the narrative here.
Oh, Cal, your thoughts, buddy?
I don't know. It all goes along with allowing the government to police itself through its own court system. Blows my mind how that ever passed any smell test way back in 1788.
Wow. But it did. Who opposed it?
The Anti-Federalists. And they pointed it out.
In
what they said too. Pretty much everything they have ever said has come to pass or is happening right now.
Oh, okay. Let me see.
The Federalist promise has happened. They've lied. The Federalist Papers was one big ad campaign full of lies. Period.
Okay. Well, did the Anti-Federalist, let's see, we talked about what happened with the Anti-Federalists, and we talked about it being a commercial enterprise. Well, here is one of those Anti-Federalists, and here is how he responded about what this Constitution was for, or who the Constitution was for in 1787. Now, here's the thing as I like to do, is I like to read these things and then prove them wrong with facts. So let's look at what this Anti-Federalist said. He said, "I am pleased to see a spirit of inquiry burst the band of constraint upon the subject of this new plan," which was the Constitution, "for consolidating the governments of the United States as recommended by the late convention. If it is suitable to the genius and habits of the citizens of these states, it will bear the strictest scrutiny. The people are the grand inquest who have a right to judge of its merits. The hideous demon of aristocracy has hitherto had so much influence as to bar the channels of investigation, preclude the people from inquiry, and extinguish every spark of liberal information of its qualities." That might have had something to do with the 50-year secrecy. "At length, the luminary of intelligence begins to beam its effulgent rays upon this important production. The deceptive mist cast before the eyes of the people by the delusive machinations of its interested advocates," the Federalist Papers, "begins to dissipate as darkness flies before the burning taper. And I dare venture to predict that in spite of those mercenary dictamers, the plan will have a candid and complete examination. Those furious zealots who are for cramming it, the Constitution, down the throats of the people without allowing them either time or opportunity to scan it or weigh it in the balance of their understandings." Let's go back here. The Federalists were the original Nancy Pelosi's, because after they wrote the Constitution, they said, "People just ratify it so you can find out what's in it." Really? Nancy Pelosi was just following the founders. "Those furious zealots who are cramming it down the throats of the people without allowing them either time or opportunity to scan or weigh it in the balance of their understandings bear the same marks in their features as those who have long been wishing to erect an aristocracy in this state, Massachusetts. Their menacing cry is for a rigid government. It matters to them little of what kind, provided it answers that description. As a plan now offered comes somewhere near their wishes and is the most consonant to their views of any they can hope for, they come boldly forward and demand that we adopt it." Wow. That's why we don't read the Anti-Federalist Papers. And the, you know, the other thing, gosh, guys, stop and think, what else did they say? You know, they had told everyone that we really needed, because the country was in serious shape, guys. I mean, it was just really, we were about to be invaded by foreign countries. All of this stuff was about to happen if we didn't adopt this Constitution. And they told the people that we were going to be invaded by France and Spain and all this other stuff. So we needed to adopt this Constitution. Well, when has a Constitution ever stopped a country from invading another country? Did Japan have any problem with that at Pearl Harbor? If we believe the wonderful lie, and Dave and I are going to talk a little bit about what's coming up Sunday, do we believe the wonderful lie that we were attacked on 9/11? But then what about the anti-federalists who wanted to say, hey, all of these dangers you say are happening? You know, let's think about Patrick Henry, Virginia Ratification Convention. He said, you tell us all of these things that we need to be afraid and we need to worry about all these people who are going to attack us. Hey, guys, we just defeated the largest army on the planet. What makes you think a piece of paper is going to keep somebody else from attacking us? So, you know, and one of the anti-federalists wrote paper, it is the title of the paper, We Have Been Told of Phantoms. So he said that, you know, basically what they were telling us was a lie. The government lie to get what they want? Surely not. Who would ever believe that? So the anti-federalists just tore them apart, guys. And the anti-federalists had something the federalists didn't have. What was that, Cal? Uh-oh, Cal's muted again. Operator error. Cal, you there? Uh-oh.
Yeah, push the button, nothing happened.
Oh.
Yeah, the anti-federalists had character. They had principles, and they stuck to them. They for the most part. I mean, some of them were moderate anti-federalists, and in the end, they caved. Others, such as Patrick Henry, were staunchly for the people's liberty.
Oh, but, you know, the anti-federalists had something else that the federalists didn't have. And that you're totally accurate. They had character. And they stood for something. But the anti-federalists had something else. They had a woman.
Mercy Otis Warren.
Yeah, who wrote under the title of a Colombian patriot. They had a gentleman named DeWitt Clinton who wrote as a countryman. They had an anonymous person who wrote as an anti-federalist as a customer. Have you ever read any of his stuff, Cal?
Yeah, recently. I have read so many anti-federalists, I'm trying to keep them straight in my head, which one said what anymore.
Well, there's so many of them, but we're not taught about them. Because if we were taught about the anti-federalist and what they said, we would see the fraud of this federal government. Because there were three federalists, and there were just an untold number of anti-federalists. You know, stop and think about these names you've never heard of. Samuel Field, William Grayson, John Lansing, Gilbert Livingston, Luther Martin, which we've mentioned before, George Clinton, Benjamin Austin, Robert Yates, George Mason, Malachi Maynard, Eleazar Oswald, John Mercer, which we mentioned before, who left the Constitutional Convention. Joseph Taylor. Just anti-federalist after anti-federalist. But the wonderful powers that be kept the anti-federalist out of academic America for 100 years. Imagine that. 100 years. So, Cal, why? Why aren't our children, why were we not taught, and why will probably the future generations never be taught about the Anti-Federalists?
Because it won't fit into the indoctrination of how wonderful this Constitution supposedly is and how wonderful this government is. It doesn't fit the indoctrination center narrative.
Well, what was it Spooner said? And stop and think about this, people. Lysander Spooner said 150 years ago that this Constitution has either allowed the problems that we have today, or it has been powerless to prevent them. And in either case, it doesn't deserve to exist. But yet today, I still see thousands of people talking about their constitutional rights. People, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18, and Article 6, Paragraph 2 tell you you have no rights. The Supreme Court in Marbury v. Madison, and also in McCulloch v. Maryland, said that your rights are subject to the federal government. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia said the same thing. The people's rights are subject to reasonable restrictions of the government. If your rights, as stated in the Declaration of Independence, are inalienable rights which are granted to you or endowed to you from your Creator, if you admit that the government has a right to put reasonable restrictions on God's rights, you are a slave. It's real simple, actually. That's what it boils down to. Comments, Dave?
Well, yeah, that about sums it up, doesn't it? Your rights are subject to reasonable restrictions. That's like necessary and proper, pretty much whatever the government says. And I think Cal's right. They're not going to teach anything about the Anti-Federalists in the future, because this government is turning into a one-party system fairly rapidly. And, you know, they plan on consolidating power on every level. And they always use these emotional issues like systemic racism to consolidate power. And they're going to continue to do so over this next couple of years. No question about it.
Well, Aristotle said very succinctly, and I'm not quoting exactly, but he said, as long as a government can keep the people divided, the government will be able to produce whatever calamity they wish to produce, because the people will be fighting each other instead of the government. And boy, are we at it big time. I mean, goodness gracious. Elmer Fudd, look at all of the violence that man created in this country. And, Pepe Le Pew, there are people out there now committing crimes, racial crimes, because of Pepe Le Pew. And Dr. Seuss, my word, people, how can we even allow that to exist? It's like I said, 500 and some people in Chicago have been shot this year. But thank goodness we got rid of Pepe Le Pew. Let's not worry about 500 and some people that got shot. Let's get rid of Pepe Le Pew. And Elmer Fudd, take Elmer Fudd's gun. Elmer's all right if he just stumbles around without a gun. Just take his gun and take, while you're at it, make sure, like you passed the laws like you did yesterday, to take all of America's guns.
Yeah, let's get rid of Dr. Seuss. That's the problem, Mike.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Dave. I had almost forgotten about that terrible man. Goodness gracious. Green eggs and ham. No wonder. Something should have been done with him a long time ago.
Clearly racist.
Clearly. Well, what's he got against green eggs? Goodness. That's racist. What's the other color eggs going to do?
Right. And again, only the federal government can decide what's fair and equitable. And that's what it's all about now.
Well, Cal, how about summing us up here? I'm going to jump in with Dave, and we're going to talk about the program coming up on Sunday. But how about you kind of summing up where we've gone with what we've talked about today? Mostly me. I apologize for blabbering on, but I'm very passionate about this issue. But kind of sum us up, please, Cal.
Well, first off, I could listen to you so-called babble on all day long. It's like I feel like a little kid sitting at Uncle Mike's, you know, sitting down and listening to you tell stories. I could listen all day long to you babble on. But to sum it up, the problem is the federal government, and I don't know so much if it's the federal government, but it's the people's clinging to and belief in the federal government as their salvation, as their solution to whatever problem there is.
Amen. Because
it's the federal government that created the problem. This is the Heligan dialect, man. Problem, solution, new problem, new solution, and people are just losing their rightful liberty with every step, willingly. And that's what this whole battle of good versus evil is all about, is people willingly surrendering their rightful liberty. The government's not even really taking it anymore. The people are surrendering it.
We are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. Endowed means they are given for life.
You're born with them.
Right. Inalienable means that they cannot be legally taken from you, which means that government which tries to do so is acting as God or more powerful than God. And if you agree to allow the government to do that as a people, to take those rights and to dominate your rights, your God is government. So don't even worry about going to church and doing all that other stuff you claim you do, because they are not your God. The government closed down your churches and told you you couldn't go. Who's your God? You fly a flag at church, the U.S. flag has to be on top above the flag of Christianity. Who's your God? Just the view from my saddle.
Like Mike?
Yes, sir.
I kind of look at it like this. I mean, the narrative is, you know, that our rights come from God. So my rights are mine because of the will of God. God willed those rights to me or to everyone else. So if I forsake my rights or forsake anyone else's rights, I am in effect forsaking the will of God. I don't understand how Christians don't understand that. I mean, when you forsake your liberty or anyone else's liberty, you are contradicting God himself. It's that simple.
Well, I couldn't argue with that in any way, shape, form, or fashion. But what you were saying just made me think of a speech that was given in 1963. And this is probably one of the most hated men in America today. So let me see if we can find a problem with this. People produce wealth, free people. And as they learn, there is little reward for ambition, that it requires faith to risk. And they have no faith. As the government must restrict and penalize and tax incentive and endeavor and must increase its expenditure of bounties, then this government must assume more and more and more police powers. And we find we are becoming a government-fearing people and not a God-fearing people. We find we have replaced faith with fear. And though we may give lip service to the Almighty, in reality, the government has become our God. It is therefore basically ungodly government, and its appeal to the pseudo-intellectual and the politician is to change their status from servant of the people to master of the people, to play at being God without faith in God and without the wisdom of God. Its pseudo-liberal spokesman and some Harvard advocates have never examined the logic of its substitution of what it calls human rights for individual rights. For its propaganda play upon words has appeal for the unthinking. Dare to think. Hey, Dave, how about we do just a couple of minutes here on what we've got planned for our listening audience on Sunday?
Yeah, well, we've got Richard Gage from Architects and Engineers from for 9/11 Truth coming on hour number two. So at 7 p.m. Eastern on Sunday night, we're going to have Richard Gage, and I guess he's going to be presenting some new findings about what happened on that fateful day of 9/11.
That is correct. In the first hour, Dave, you and I and our treasured friend, D.W., Daryl Wayne, who is a retired commercial airline pilot and was the first commercial airline pilot to fly into New York City after 9/11. So good old Daryl Wayne offers some wonderful insight into what it was like in that eerie atmosphere to fly the first plane into New York City and what his observations were as he did so. And
well, that'll be great.
And for the three of us to be able to discuss that subject, and then have Dr. Gage to come on the second hour, and being the founder of the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, I think Sunday should be a powerful presentation, and I would like to invite everyone to join us. I hope you can listen in, Cal.
I'll be listening in. I'm looking forward to that completely.
Well, as are we. I think it's going to be a great opportunity for the folks to listen to an actual engineer discuss the properties of the collapse of World Trade Center Building Number 7 that wasn't hit by a damn thing.
Yeah. And it'll be great to pick Daryl Wayne's brain too. He has a unique perspective as a, you know, a former pilot, a commercial pilot for many, many years, and get his take on this as well. This would be a great evening.
Especially the part about good old Daryl Wayne and his being able to tell us about the properties of aircraft, about what it's like to fly a 757 or a 747, and could he, as an accomplished pilot, have a plane do or accomplish what people who had no experience whatsoever to speak of were able to do with a huge commercial airliner? Which
right, and what maneuvers are possible without the plane coming apart at the seams midair.
Exactly. This is going to be an interesting time for sure. Well, Cal, buddy, I just can't thank you enough for coming on. Dave, always it's a pleasure. You do such a great job as a producer, and your comments are so prescient and right on. So I want to thank both of you guys. I appreciate you. Those of you who took the time and the trouble to listen in, appreciate you as well. And so we're going to be bailing off here very shortly as soon as the music starts. So just want to thank you guys. Appreciate you. Again, Cal, thanks so very much. Dave, appreciate you, buddy.
Thank you.
listening to Revolution Radio.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We talk about decentralization and bank and I feel Bitcoin, Litecoin, MyCoin, YourCoin, Blockchain, baby. Mondays at 1600 hours Eastern Studio A.
This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning, warning.